Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Anna Racer and Leila McNeil about their new book, Forces of Nature, The Women Who Changed Science. From the ancient worlds to the present, women have been critical to the progress of science, yet their importance is overlooked. Their stories lost, distorted, or actively suppressed. Forces of Nature sets the record straight and charts the fascinating history of women's discoveries in science. In the ancient and medieval world, women served as royal physicians and nurses, taught mathematics, studied the stars, and practiced midwifery. As natural philosophers, physicists, anatomists, and botanists, they were central to the great intellectual flourishing of the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment. More recently, women have been crucially involved in the Manhattan Project, pioneering space missions, and much more. Despite their record of illustrious achievements, even today, very few women will win Nobel Prizes in science. In this thoroughly researched, authoritative work, you will discover how women have navigated a male-dominated scientific culture, showing themselves to be pioneers and trailblazers, often without any recognition at all. Well, Anna, Leila, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, it's really great to have you here. All right. So as we witnessed the unprecedented times of the global COVID pandemic, I was just wondering if we can start by you reflecting on how it affected you and your work, and also maybe some takeaways that you gathered from all of this experience. And we will start with Anna.
Oh, sure. You know, it's difficult to put a book out during a global pandemic. We were sort of fortunate in that most of the writing and editing and everything took place before all of this happened, but the book was scheduled to come out in the fall of 2020, and so that definitely put a damper on things. And then it was difficult to, for me at least, it was really hard to imagine putting a book out into such a world. You know, we weren't going to be able to go on tour. We weren't going to be able to like go to bookstores to do that. It was just a really strange, it was a really strange experience, I think. I'm not sure what else to say about it.
Yeah. And you yourself, how did you adjust?
I didn't. I'm sure that will catch up with me eventually, but yeah, no, I didn't. I had a lot of family stuff that was going on at the same time that was really difficult, and so I think it only feels like just now that I'm kind of being able to reflect on everything, it was just kind of really full on for the whole year.
Well, I do appreciate your honesty in that, because many people would try to sort of sugarcoat it a little bit, you know, just to appear that they've coped. But most of us didn't. I can say for myself as well, yeah. And Layla, what about you?
Same that Anna said about having a book come out during this time with a lot of the limitations that were put on how we were able to interact with readers, and not being able to do much in the way of like one-on-one in-person interaction with readers. And that was difficult. And I mean, also on a personal level, it was difficult to have a book come out in the summer of 2021 during the pandemic. I lost people during the pandemic that I would have been so overjoyed to have shared this book with, and this project, family members who've seen me want to be a writer and saw me going through the writing process, didn't get to enjoy the kind of end result. And that was kind of, a bittersweet part for me.
Oh, I'm very sorry about that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that it's something that thousands, if not, you know, millions of people experienced as well. So yes, I'm sure there are a lot of people listening out there that understands that.
Okay. So last pandemic question, how was your sourdough?
I have a tiny kitchen. I can't make bread in my kitchen. It's way too small. But I did have, my friends did make me some, and it was very good. And I did have a friend give me a sourdough starter, which I neglected and killed. Shh, don't tell anybody.
Oh dear.
I did not make any sourdough, but I did make many different kinds of breads that I hadn't made before. And it was a good distraction. Some of them were like a 5-hour process. So, you know, that was a nice 5-hour distraction out of a day that was, you know, bombarded by bad news. So I did do some bread, just not sourdough.
No, fair enough. All right. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? And we'll start with Anna.
Sure. I am a historian of science, technology, and medicine, more technology than anything. I have a PhD from the University of Oklahoma. And I, with Layla, I am the co-founder and co-editor-in-chief of Lady Science, which is an online magazine and podcast about women and gender in the history of science. And that collaboration with Layla was the sort of beginning of our writing partnership and more or less the reason that the book came to be, I think.
And
so how did you get interested in the history of science and science journalism?
Well, I actually, my background is in art, and I guess I just usually tell people when I graduated from art school, grad school really was the best career option for me. So I had taken some like upper division history surveys. And so I was young. I didn't really think about it very much. I applied to some graduate programs, and Oklahoma gave me the best deal. So I went there, and I really did fall very deeply in love with that work. And when I'm not doing Lady Science or Forces of Nature type stuff, my interest is the American Space Program in the 1960s. And it just was incredible to me that to learn, I guess, when I was younger, that this is something you can do, something you can study, the history of science, the history of technology, and then all of the really fascinating kind of ways into things I was already interested in that come from that kind of lens. And I'm, you know, it obviously changed my life, and that's where I met Layla. So it all worked out pretty good, I think.
Mm-hmm. And Layla?
I am also a historian of science, technology, and medicine. Unlike Anna, less technology, more science and medicine. So I guess our partnership kind of equalizes out in that way. And I, like Anna said, we met at University of Oklahoma, where I was in the History of Science graduate program. And I worked on, for my big research project, a German woman physician at the turn of the 20th century. And that's really how I started on my road, working on women and gender in the history of science. And I don't work in academia anymore. I am a freelance writer, and I helped launch the Women Who Shaped Science series at Smithsonian.com. And I now write for BBC Future on similar topics of women and gender in the history of science, and also for various other outlets, including Lady Science Magazine. And we also have the Lady Science podcast that I co-host with Anna and our managing editor, Rebecca Ortenberg. And so, yeah, this is kind of the work that I do 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that you reconcile this art with science, and you sort of bring the specific perspective to scientific topics. But I also was wondering, did you always have this passion for communication of different topics like art or science to others?
No. Well, okay. I guess when I was an artist, I did shows and things, and I was invested in making sure that people saw my work and being part of a community that way. And I think when Layla and I were in grad school, that was one of the things that I was really missing, was that kind of feeling of being part of a larger community. Obviously, we had, you know, our cohort in grad school and the academic community, but having come from somewhat outside of that, I felt that I really wanted that to be part of my life as well, going forward. And also that the topics that Layla and I were most interested in, particularly like women and gender, were just not like a huge part of our graduate curriculum. And they're still kind of a marginal kind of niche in the larger academic community of the history of science. And I think we both thought that that was really unfortunate because, you know, some of the things we read in high school really changed the way, or in high school, in grad school, really changed the way that we thought about not just our academic interests and, you know, how to do scholarship like this, but also just how we thought about the world. It definitely changed it for me. And there were, at the time when we started Lady Science, there, you know, that was sort of the heyday of the academic blog. And there just wasn't really a lot out there that focused on the kinds of things that we were most interested in. And so as we typically do whenever we start a project, we just went for it without planning too much, because it was just something that we wanted to do and we saw a place for it. So I think the interest in like doing this kind of like public facing work grew out of just needing a place for ourselves to do it. And there's no reason not to make it public. So that's kind of what we did.
So all of this basically culminated in one of your projects, which is the book, The Forces of Nature. So what is it about, and how did you come to writing it?
Go for it, Layla.
Okay. The book is about, it really offers an alternative to the very popular compendiums of like biographies, like individual biographies of women in science that are very popular and very important to kind of a public consciousness around the history of women in science. But ours doesn't so much focus on individuals and their individual biographies. We are much more invested in placing women in their historical and cultural context with other women who were participating in science, technology, and medicine around the same time, to really show how those cultural moments shaped women's lives and careers, and how in turn women shaped those cultural and historical moments as well. Just to give us a little bit of a deeper, richer, more textured understanding into the history of science and how gender and women have shaped that conception of history and science. And we came to writing this book really out, like Anna said earlier, grew out of Lady Science in that the things we were interested in and when we created Lady Science are the same things we bring into the book itself. But on a more like technical level, how this book came to be, the publisher found us through Lady Science as well and reached out to us and thought or wondered if we would be interested in writing a book for them. And it did actually start out, what they wanted was a book of individual biographies. And Anna and I kind of, we discussed amongst ourselves and we're like, that's not really what we're into. It's great, you know, that they want us to write a book and this would be our first book and that would be great to have a book. But we really wanted to kind of push it a little bit more towards what me and Anna do and what we think is important to put out there into the world. And so we settled with the publisher on what the book has become, which is more of a more holistic look at women in the history of science rather than individual biographies.
Yes, for sure. And it's such an interesting way to put it. And as you say, to put actually women in the context within the history. So what roles did women play in the history of science?
Basically anything you can imagine. The book covers basic, it has a kind of like textbook kind of layout so that it covers, you know, antiquity to the present. So there are women in basically any discipline that you can imagine. And one of the things that we really tried to do is to draw out some of these stories that are not as well known and to kind of think about why they're not as well known. So, you know, Marie Curie isn't in the book at all, except at the very end, because I think everybody is, you know, at least passingly familiar with her story. And also she is one of those people who, the reason we are familiar with her story is that she has all the kind of like traditional accolades that we associate with science, you know, her two Nobel Prizes and her publications. And not that Marie Curie didn't deserve all of those things or actually work very hard to get them because she was a woman in a male-dominated field. It's just that the nature of science is not one solely of like individual geniuses making, you know, these earth-shattering discoveries. Science is done by people in collaboration in communities. And so we wanted to also look at people who just kind of just did science, just sort of plugged away at this work and were very diligent in their sort of pursuit of knowledge about nature, but maybe didn't get Nobel Prizes, maybe, you know, because they were unknown or because they weren't allowed to publish or whatever. So, and then also like, as you go back into the earlier period, we're looking at activities that are not always classified as science. We talk a lot about midwifery and nursing as professions that have been historically feminized professions, mostly women doing this work, and are not often classified as scientific or medical work in like a professional sense, in part because it's mostly women doing it. So in terms of like roles that are played, yes, you have your Marie Curies and you have your Florence Nightingales and your Rosalind Franklins, but you also have people who are working as anthropologists and archaeologists in relative obscurity, who are doing that work because they want to study their own heritage and to better understand it and to see it in through their own eyes instead of the eyes of like white colonizers. We talk about myths and magic and mysticism and all these ways that women are creating and codifying knowledge of nature in ways that people are not considering science at all. Any role you can think of, really, from, you know, principal investigator to human computer to lab assistant to field technician to midwife to whatever.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So as you mentioned, your book is written in chronological order. So from the antiquity, then Middle Ages, and all the way to the modern day. So we're just wondering if you can tell us about a couple of women from all of these different time periods that stand out most for you.
I think I'll start, I guess, at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So when the book starts with the antiquity period and Middle Ages, and one thing I want to note about studying antiquity is that we have very few records of an individual life from this time period for both women and men. And it is definitely more difficult to find sources on women during this time period. And so one of the ways that we look, I mean, everyone knows kind of about Hypatia of Alexandria, and largely through kind of the sensational death that she underwent. But what we do, instead of just focusing on Hypatia, which a lot of people know and can Google her story to understand who she was, is we look at where the gaps are in our understanding of women in antiquity. And where there are gaps, we try to make educated guesses based on the sources that we do have of if a woman was participating in science during this time, what would that look like? We have kind of an idea of what science and mathematics looked like during this time. So if a woman was part of that, how would that go? What would that look like? And one thing that we're very clear about in the book is being clear about what we don't know. And when we are making those educated guesses. And then when we move into the Middle Ages, when we have more printed, written materials, We do come across some figures. One of the ones that we write about in the book is Hildegard of Bingen. And she was an abbess, but she was also a polymath. She composed her own music. She wrote natural history. She did so many different things. And what we focus on in the book is her cosmology and how she received her cosmological visions of the universe through mysticism, through divine union with God. And as a woman in the church, it was through these visions, through being able to claim mysticism, that she was able to have any sort of recognition in cosmology. The only way that she could really be listened to was to claim this as union with God, that these weren't visions of her own mind, that they were visions coming from God. And we don't usually put Hildegard in the category of cosmologist, but she was very much participating in the discussion of medieval understandings of the universe through religion. And we thought that that was a really important angle to kind of tease out of her story. And then when we move into the Renaissance, we have women like Maria Kunitz, who was an astronomer and mathematician, and she published a book on her own dime, which was a book of astronomical tables. And she was very much well-versed in what was going on in astronomy at that time. She was an advocate for Kepler and his three laws of planetary motion, which were somewhat new at the time. She published her book in German and Latin, which was a really innovative approach because German was not yet a scientific language. So it made this work more accessible to people outside of the academic elite, which were reading Latin. And that book helped establish German as a scientific language going forward. And her story is really extraordinary, and we usually don't think about her in the context of you know, the history of astronomy or the history of mathematics, because you know, you did have your Keplers of the time, and usually those are the people who kind of, you know, suck up all the air in the room. but then, you know, going forward from there, we have women in the 19th century who at the time, there were so many technological advancements in printing going on. We have the introduction of the steam press. We have increased rates of literacy. And so those two things kind of combined to have a boom in publishing and for the public and scientific publishing for the public. So science popularizations, and women really cornered the market on popular science writing during the 19th century, especially in the areas of botany, marine biology, fossils, all sorts of things women were writing about. And they really shaped the public culture of science in the 19th century. And we don't really think about that as performing science, but when you're reaching that many people, you're shaping the scientific understanding of an entire country. I find that a pretty significant contribution to the history of science. And then of course, in the 20th century, you've got, more women entering higher education. So, you know, we have more women entering all different kinds of fields, from psychology to chemistry to physics, medicine. And, you know, when we get into the 1960s with the civil rights movement, we have more Black women and queer women entering scientific fields. And shaping our understanding of those fields through their lived perspectives as Black women, as queer women. And Some notables from there. One would be Mamie Phipps Clark. She was a Black psychologist from Columbia. And she was really fighting against the scientific racism in the field at the time. And one of her psychology projects where she was looking at how race and racial identity impacts Black children and at what age that happens. And it's popularly known as the doll test. And what they found was pretty alarming was that children in segregated schools start to internalize negative perceptions about Black children and Black people at a much earlier age. And that study was used as evidence for desegregating schools in Brown versus Board of Education. And that was the very first time that a social science had been used as evidence in a Supreme Court case. And so really what's important in this story is that it took a Black woman to shape the knowledge that we have about psychology and race. That before that, you know, a white woman could not bring that lived experience to the work. And so really what we're trying to show with these stories is that the more diverse experiences that you have in science, that actually shapes the way science is produced. And that shapes the knowledge that we have. And one of the reasons it's important to, you know, kind of break up this homogenized white guys club of science that has reigned for so long. And then we kind of end in the present day with women like Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who is still living. She discovered pulsars, and she was overlooked for a Nobel Prize. And it went to, I believe, Anna, right? Her male professor.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, okay. But really what we're trying to show when we come into the present is that, you know, you have read this entire book from antiquity to now. We have shown you that it's not a question of if women have participated in science. We have shown you that they have. And so what we need to move towards now is breaking down those systems and structures that have kept women from view and keep women from succeeding and excelling into higher positions. We really want to turn the gaze from getting women into science, showing you these role models to get you there, and looking at the overall systemic oppressions that make women leave. And that's kind of where we end, looking at things like, you know, investigating how sexual harassment and sexual violence and things like that shape the experience of women in STEM, which keeps them from pursuing careers and advancing into leadership positions within the field. So yeah, that's kind of... That was a really long answer. I apologize.
No, it's really great, really detailed. So the point that I really appreciate that actually both of you made, that many women, they just didn't have this kind of spotlight on them, like, for example, Marie Curie did, like Anna told us. And many of them, they just did their work without actually asking for like acknowledgement as such. So the way you would raise your children, you just do it because you have to and you love your children and you don't ask for like fanfares and Nobel Prizes for it.
Right.
So I think there was a bit of a lack of acknowledgement as such for the image of the women in science in those days.
Well, I think that there were a lot of women who were asking to be heard and were kind of clawing at the edges of the kind of the scientific establishment. People in, you know, some women like in the 19th century did put up a pretty big fight to be able to present their work to the Royal Society, for example. someone like, if for a later example, someone like Vera Rubin, who is a cosmologist and astronomer, she wrote a incredible paper providing evidence for dark matter, and her advisor told her, well, obviously you can't go to the conference and present it because you have a baby. And she said, excuse me? He was like, I'll present it for you, but I have to put my name on it if I'm going to do that. And so she said, absolutely not. and went to the conference anyway and presented it herself. I think that also one of the things that we try to be really careful of in thinking about women in the past is to try not to use our understanding of these kinds of structural oppressions and marginalizations to strip women of their agency. Because I think that a lot of women who were doing this work knew the score. They knew that they could spend all their time lobbying to get into a scientific society and not get it, or they could spend their time working and do their work. So I think in terms of like asking for recognition, I think it's important to remember also that like these women knew what they were doing. They understood the culture that they were part of. And I think there was a lot of just picking your battles going on, you know? And it's important to us to try to make space for that agency wherever we can, to think about how women understood the social worlds that they were part of and how they navigated them, and often how they bent those rules or used them to their own advantage. Layla mentioned about this sort of publishing boom in the 19th century that a lot of women became part of. They saw an opening. Publishing houses didn't have enough male authors to cover the demand for natural history writing. And so women stepped into that gap and made, you know, successful careers for themselves in ways that they knew they could, you know, that they could write from home while still caring for their home and their families. They could anonymize themselves and pretend to be men. Like, they understood what they were doing and the systems that they were part of, and they still managed to like make their own way. And so I think that's something that we really want to remember when we look back into the past and talk about structural issues, is that they are not like, they are embedded systems, not sort of these like overpowering like laws of nature. And they're embedded in the same social world that these women are, and they understood them.
That's excellent clarification. It's really, yeah, it really clarifies everything. So I was just wondering, what were the differences between different places in the world? So are the women in the Western world versus Eastern world, for example?
So one of the, I do want to acknowledge that that is one of the limitations of the book, that Anna and I've worked largely in the 19th and early 20th century, and Anna works largely in the mid 20th century. So of the US and Europe. And so we are kind of, we don't have infinite time to write a book, and we are somewhat bound by our own expertise. And so we did try to cover as much as we could globally, also with the languages that we know. You know, we are kind of bound by that as well, on how far geographically we can go. So I do want to just put that out there, that is one of the limitations of the book. But what we do cover globally, we cover Egypt and China. One of the things we find pretty much in every geographical area that we looked is that women have always participated in medicine in some to some degree, that they've been performing, as Anna mentioned earlier, as midwives, and also just the expectation that women care for women and children, that also seems to be a somewhat global issue and global phenomenon, mm-hmm. which has made medicine historically an area kind of rife with women. So even though we find in many places women were barred from getting medical degrees, that women were still caring for their families and their communities with their own types of medicinal cures through delivering babies, taking care of pregnant women, and all of that has typically fallen to women. And that is something we do find pretty globally.
So then as we move towards present day, what are women's roles in modern day science?
So not to like be hostile to the question, I think as with the past, women have always done science and women are doing science now. And I think one of the things that I would really like to see is how we can reframe this discussion, not in terms of like identifying and highlighting women's sort of novelty in science. It's important to understand the ways that women struggle to become scientists and to excel at the same level as men. But this is just never a question that we ask about men. What are men's roles in science? They're scientists, you know? And I think thinking, again, what Layla said about instead of thinking about individuals in that way, or even roles and kind of categorizations, for me, it's more productive to think about the larger structures of scientific culture, particularly Western science, and to think about what the role of women is in that culture in kind of a meta way. So not asking about like the reality on the ground of what, you know, what a woman does at work every day, but asking how does science itself as a culture and a community see women, and what can we do to change those perceptions if they are negative and if they are negatively impacting women's ability to practice science. And it is kind of, it's kind of like a wibbly conversation to have, and a difficult thing to parse, because it is about thinking through, you know, the culture of science itself and how it frames the people within it, and who is responsible for making the decisions about those kinds of framing. And I don't, you know, I don't know that we have like a good answer for it now. We have not. Layla and I didn't solve the problem. Like, sorry.
But, oh dear.
But I think one way to do that is to look at the past and to use our lens as historians, as analysts, to think about it that way, to think about cultures and social worlds, as opposed to, it's just simply, for me, it is too easy for that to become a slippery slope where then the blame always ends up on women for not being in the pipeline, instead of investigating what the pipeline itself looks like and if it's full of tumbleweeds and spiders and stuff or whatever. You know, that's a weird metaphor. I apologize.
Very scientific. So I really appreciate the point that you made. So it's more systematic obstacles for women's place, more visible in science, really. And as you say, we shouldn't really have to ask this question. So in ideal world, we wouldn't even have this kind of discussion about women's place in the sciences, because it would just be like a normal thing for women to be there. So what are any, if any, success stories on how, as community, we really start to improve on how women are represented in sciences?
I think, I mean, just looking at the progress since women were allowed to join higher education in the end of the 19th century to today, I mean, there has been undeniable progress. It started out with white women being able to enter into higher education, and Black women fighting to also be there. And so, you know, we have seen higher numbers across demographics of women entering into higher education in the sciences. So there definitely has been some progress there. There has definitely not been enough progress in the acceptance of women of color as scientists. I think one of the things that Anna and I joke about is that we're all still suffering from a 19th century hangover. about women's place, about the place of women of color, all of these kind of 19th century stereotypes about how we scientifically classified women and women of color. And, you know, during that time period is when we really got the emergence of what a scientist looks like physically looks like a white dude in a lab. And so we still bring all of those stereotypes and all of those understandings of what a woman is and what a man is into our understandings of what a scientist can be and who a scientist can be. And that is still very limiting for any woman who wants to pursue a science as a career. And one of the things that we have not done a good job of doing is looking at science as an institution that was built by white men. And because we have not had that reckoning, we're still trying to find ways to put women, white women and women of color, into a system that was never built for them. And that's one of the things that we really want our historical work to do, is to show that if the system was built by white men, we can build something different and we can build something better that is much more inclusive of human difference. And I don't know if that's more of a digression, but I think it's more of a stalemate, that until we can kind of tear down those structures, we're going to continue to have this problem of women leaving scientific fields before they can excel into leadership positions. I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, for sure. And we do indeed need more systematic interventions to change the system itself, as you say, to have more equitable representation of women in scientific establishment.
Yeah, absolutely. And because when, you know, we peel back the layers still of, you know, we can have the role models of a woman in a field, but that's really the first layer. When you start peeling it back and you see still who's like controlling funding, who's controlling access to research that women need, who's running universities, who's running labs, things like that, you keep going back and back and back, and you find that it's still largely white men controlling those larger systems. And when you have, you know, as we've seen in the last several years, like all, when we keep pulling back those layers, we keep seeing the men who are controlling these are serial harassers. And you know, serial abusers of grad students. And those types of things matter. It's not just about having the woman role model. It's about going back and back and back through the system to see where the failures are. And sometimes those failures go all the way to the top.
Yeah, for sure. So I was just wondering, what discoveries along your journey to writing Forces of Nature surprised you the most?
Well, I think there are two things that were shocking to me. One is that some of the women that, so we began the process by just kind of making a list of women in science and then thinking about ways that we could group them kind of thematically, either by, you know, their discipline or time period or certain experiences they had in common to talk about these kind of larger historical contexts. So as we were going through our list, we were using a lot of resources from outside to make this list to start with. And we did find that at least a couple of people on our list were not real people and never existed. And also, and not just were like mythical figures in history, but were like made up by the internet. Hmm. One of those is Merit Ta, who was supposedly the first woman physician in ancient Egypt. It is pretty clear that she never existed. So we had to kind of go back then and figure out, all right, what is the deal with women doctors in ancient Egypt then? Because it's clear to me now that this person is not a real person and there is no like archaeological evidence for her. So going back through and digging through that, and like Layla said, with the kind of limitations that we have in terms of our own expertise, and like, obviously I don't read hieroglyphics. So the best we were able to do in good faith was to make some inferences about what it might be like to be a woman doctor in this period using the sources that we could find. And then I think the thing that I'm not actually that shocked that the internet invented a woman first, because of the way that we consume media about women in science as like clickbait listicles that go around every time there's a birthday or an anniversary or a Google Doodle or whatever. You know, everybody has to write a piece about it to get on the hashtag bandwagon. And that stuff just gets churned out and repeated and sourcing gets lost and misattributed. And so that didn't surprise me. I think what surprised me the most is the really sort of deeply personal and often traumatic realities of the stories that we talk about. You know, everybody always wants to ask us about like all these successes and stuff. But one of the things that I think we found was just how often women were just slapped down by the world. And whether we're talking about like Jewish scientists fleeing Europe to escape Nazi persecution and death, and then coming up against the sort of hard wall of American immigration policy in the 20th century and how difficult it was for some of these women scientists to escape with their lives and then try to have another life somewhere else, because the universities that they were trying to get jobs at, which you had to have a job in order to immigrate, weren't taking women scholars. So things like that. There are some stories in the book that we don't go into super detail about, but like just interpersonal stories of like intimate partner violence and abuse that people suffered. And I think when we think about and consume media about women in science, oftentimes we're looking for happy endings and we're looking for heroic stories, but it's just as important to look at this sort of dark underside of this, because this is the reality for these women. They lived through this. Some of them didn't survive it. So it was shocking to me in that sense, just because I think we're so oversaturated with positive narratives and it made me really rethink the way that I approach this history in my own scholarship, in my own thinking, and I hope that it does that for readers as well.
Yes, for sure. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So I would like to ask, what are you currently working on and what would be your next project?
I am currently working on a proposal for another book. Unfortunately, I'm not writing this one with Anna. I'm still sending her all the things I'm writing and telling her to comment on them and help me. But the book I'm writing is a reframing of the modern history of astronomy and cosmology through the work of Henrietta Swan Leavitt. She was a Harvard woman computer who devised a very key relationship between light and distance. And that has become the measuring stick by which we have measured the galaxies and the universe for the last century. And I will be kind of following this distance measuring stick through the 20th century to today.
That sounds super exciting. I hope you come and talk to us about your book once it's done.
Yeah, I have to write it first. Oh boy.
And Anna?
Yeah, it looks like my next big project will be a conference or symposium type of thing, and an edited volume that Asif Siddiqui, who is a historian of spaceflight, is putting together. And it's about disruption and displacement and colonialism related to the space programs of the 20th century. And my focus is on Kennedy Space Center in Florida and the kind of environmental history of that place and how it is entwined with our narratives about spaceflight and what spaceflight means for Americanism and for like thinking about frontiers and colonizing space and things like that. So I think that's the next big thing for me that I'm working on.
That sounds really interesting. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and your book?
So if you go to forcesofnaturebook.com, you can find all the information about the book, including links to order it, and you can see some reviews and other places where we've talked about the book if you are interested in hearing more. And then you can find me on Twitter at Anna N. Reeser, and my website is annareeser.com.
You can find me, Layla, on Twitter at Layla Sedai. It's at LEILASEDAI. And my website is laylamcneil.com. And if you are interested in learning about the magazine and podcast that Anna and I have founded and run together, you can go to ladyscience.com.
Excellent. Well, thanks to both of you for joining me today. It's been a truly thought-provoking discussion.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you for having us on.